Hi, listeners, and welcome to the David Crit podcast. I'm your host, Britt Lawton, and today I'm bringing you an extracted interview from an Instagram live stream between Roger Ballen and Timon Smith. This took place on our David Crit Bookstore Instagram account on the 22nd of April, 2020. This interview was arranged between the David Crit Bookstore, Jonathan Wall Publishers, Roger Ballen and Timon Smith. In the interview, the two discuss some biographical history relating to Roger's career, the evolution of his work, the latest exhibition, as well as the new book, The World According to Roger Ballen. They also discuss Roger's plans for his new photography center, which is opening in Johannesburg, South Africa in 2020. David Crit Projects is also hosting an online exhibition in partnership with Artsy titled The World According to Roger Ballen. This features some of his latest photographs as well as the book. I hope you enjoy this episode.
How are you on this 20-something day of lockdown in Johannesburg?
I think it's the 25th from what I gather. Every day I'm posting another Instagram and I say day 25, lockdown Johannesburg. So I think today I said 25th, but okay. I might be wrong.
And have you been keeping yourself suitably busy and avoiding going crazy?
Yeah, I've been making paintings and drawings on canvas for the first time since 1973. So it's actually been a very productive time for me, because I don't think I would have found the time or the energy, the focus to actually do this. And I've been wanting to do it for years and years and years. And so this is actually a monumental period from an artistic point of view, because the paintings are going well, the drawings are going well, and it's taken me into a zone that and media that I wanted to be involved in for a long time. And I got some momentum now. And so it's been very productive. If for some reason I hadn't done this, I think you might have seen me not sitting here, but crawling on the wall somewhere.
Okay, well, people are here, and I've asked them to put comments on so that we can address some questions later on. But obviously, you and I have had many conversations over the years, but let's start at the very beginning. Perhaps we could discuss some brief biographical background. You're 70 this year. You were born and raised in Rye, New York. Is that right?
Yeah, I was born in Manhattan and then spent my adolescent period in Westchester in Rye, New York.
So I'm wondering, in terms of that period in your life, what sort of environment did you grow up in, specifically related to the arts and photography in particular?
Well, I think the most important thing was, firstly, as a teenager, I wasn't interested in the arts. I hardly knew what art was, and I didn't have any inquiring mind about the art. But my mother joined Magnum in the mid-1960s, and met some of the most famous photographers in the world and started working with them. So during this time, I got to know people like, I didn't get to know, they were not that interested in me, but they came to the house, people like Cartier-Bresson and Bruce Davids and Elliot Erwitt, Cortez. So they were very fond of my mother and gave her books and photographs and were very happy to be around her and used her as a person that helped administer their lives. And so my mother developed a deep passion for photography, and that wore off on me. And so I remember very clearly when I was graduated from high school, which was in June 1968, my parents gave me a Nikon FDN camera, and I immediately knew what to do with that camera. And so when I was 18 years old, I was actually able to take refined photographs. And so the baseline for what I did was established by age 18 by the interaction between the Magnum photographers and people like Cortez and my mother.
So you took that camera and you went to Berkeley. And you went to Berkeley in a particular kind of turbulent period in American history. I'm wondering what kind of an influence that environment had on your thinking about the world and what you were beginning to think your place in it might be going forward out of university, etc.
Yeah, well, this was a really unique period, and I was at the heart of the storm, if you want to say that. Berkeley was the sort of the core of the whole counterculture hippie movement in the late 60s, early 70s. So it had a, I think it had a major influence on me in a lot of ways. It was a very free-thinking movement. It was a spontaneous thing, and it was very geared in a way towards people's psyche. I mean, my first degree there was in psychology, and I got very interested in finding the core, finding my deeper side, my shadow side, as Jung would say. So it was a period of getting to know your deeper self in a way. And I think this rubbed off on me, even though perhaps, you know, the germination was already there before I even went to Berkeley. I remember reading Sartre's book on existentialism when I was 16, 17, and it already hit something in my head, laid another foundation for who I was. I mean, I think I had this artistic inclination before I got to Berkeley because I started taking pictures before I went to college. And so when I went there, you know, there was this a need to find out about who you actually were, not just as a human being, as a psychological being, not necessarily a product of a corporate America. I mean, that's what we rebelled against, of being part of a larger machine, being part of a government that we felt was intruding on people, and we rejected the so-called middle class ethic that pervaded American society, and I assume it still does. And so there was a sense of rebellion. I guess I left Berkeley with it. You know, I didn't want to become part of a middle class society. I wanted to find myself. And so in 1973, this is quite important because it goes back to some of the things I started talking about in the beginning. My mother died in 1973. And after she died, I spent 4 months or 5 months doing what I've actually did in the last 4 weeks, painting on canvas. And this is actually the last time I ever did it. And that was like a totally intense period. I got this apartment in New York City and sat there day and night and made paintings. I don't know how many I made. I must have made 30 or 40 of these things. And then after that, I decided I didn't want to be in America anymore. I had just had it. I didn't know what I was, what I wanted to do. And I felt a need to find myself. And I found part of myself in the painting, but I needed to move onward. And I told my father that I was going to be away for a few months. I decided I was going to go to Greece and Israel, and I ended up being away for 5 years.
And going back to just before that, I know that you've mentioned it a lot, and you've mentioned it in particular with regard to this new body of work that we're talking about in the world according to Roger Ballen, and that's the influence of R.D. Lang and anti-psychiatry on your thinking. And especially when in relation to ideas about how we view sanity and insanity. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit more about that in terms of how it's influenced your view of the world and the way that you produce your work.
Well, yeah, I think he was an important influence on me, and I think a lot of people during this time, because he brought up this issue, what is insane and what is not insane. And you know, obviously, there are people who have serious emotional problems, and so we don't necessarily think, you know, sanity exists on every sphere. There are people who have extreme emotional problems, and this may be reflected in extreme conservatism or extreme schizophrenia. We wouldn't know. I wouldn't want to make that comment. But the issue of sanity was a very important thing. And I think the thing that was most important to me is when I look back upon what I do and people say, Roger, are you a political photographer? I say, yeah, what do you mean by that? You know, does politics in art have to be only about who you vote for in an election? I said, my politics are about politics of the mind, which is what R.D. Lang was talking about the divide itself. The issue of having one part of the mind being able to talk to the other part of the mind. And I think this had an important influence on me, because my politics wasn't necessarily about changing the world through who I would vote for and which politician I would identify with. My politics was about trying to get my art to make people's mind talk to itself and find itself and renew itself and to find an identity that lay buried behind, you know, repression. So repression was the key word in R.D. Lang and the way I thought of myself. I thought of art as a way of liberating repression. And I, to this day, say the same thing over and over again. The human species can't improve unless individuals take responsibility for liberating themselves. And this is a very much a 1960s concept that came out of the counterculture. And I still believe it. You know, I still believe it. You know, you got to find yourself, respect yourself, and come to terms with who you are in an honest way.
And going back quickly to the paintings, which I think they made an appearance in Balinese, and they also make an appearance in this book. You were a self-taught painter, and you've spoken about how it felt to paint during that difficult time after your mother died. But how did you feel about painting in terms of it being a possible art practice that you would then perhaps change from photography to decide to dedicate your life to at that initial stage?
Yeah, see, the thing is I never went to art school. I never went to photography school. And the painting that I did at the time, I think it was really interesting, but I never saw myself as a professional painter. I don't think I had the skills at that time to manifest that. And I think subconsciously, I realized that I didn't have certain skills. And I also felt that it wasn't the right thing for me to spend 24 hours a day in an apartment. I really had a need to travel and to move on. And I liked the idea of being on the street and experiencing life on the street, meeting people, being at events, and finding, finding the unknown in moving from place to place. So I didn't see myself as a painter, but during this time that I did paint, I really learned a lot about visual arts. So I learned a lot about what composition was about, what tonality was about, what putting a picture together was about. So it played a huge role in terms of my ability to compose a picture in a coherent way, painting. And I still say to many students, if I was running an art school or a photography school, that one of the first courses I would make the students take would be a drawing or painting class, because you put things together piece by piece by piece, and you have to learn how to fit them together. Whereas photography is very much a global vision. And a lot of people don't put all the pieces together in an image.
Those travels, they took you all over the world, from Cairo to Cape Town, Istanbul to New Guinea, all over the place. It was also the first time that you arrived in South Africa, but we'll talk about that a bit later. But you took your camera on those travels, and you started taking particular photos, which would eventually become the photos that ended up in your first published book, Boyhood. Was that a conscious decision from the beginning of the travels, or was it just something that you were interested in and you continued taking photos of while you were traveling, and then after that they kind of ended up forming the material for a book?
No. Firstly, when I started, I didn't have the idea of doing a book on Boyhood. Pictures that had something to do with what I was involved in painting. I was sort of emulating something that I saw in so-called field painting. You can see some of those works were quite abstract in many ways. You had a whole field in the picture where everything was in focus and things would move out of this field. So for many months during this travel, the pictures had they were moving between abstraction and these so-called field painting photographs and other things I was taking pictures of, whether they had a documentary aspect to them or a somewhat surreal aspect to them. So I was going out of many different zones in these pictures. And it only happened one night when I was walking in a dark alleyway in Colombo's salon. and I saw two boys arm in arm. You know, children that age, about 6, 7 years old, it's called the latency period in psychology. That the boys like the boys and the girls like the girls. And, you know, I remember it. And so when I saw these two boys with arms around each other, all of a sudden it was like a bolt of lightning. I remember my childhood. You know, I had friends that I used to do that with in a, you know, we were real pals together and did everything together. It was like our first times exploring the world. And so all of a sudden, this bolt went through my head, and I, all of a sudden, I'd forgotten about my childhood, actually. You know, I was maybe, you know, 16, 17 years of very childhood. And all of a sudden, the concept of doing a project on boyhood was actually parallel to myself trying to find my past. So basically, that was what it was. It was a psychological journey into my past. And all my projects since then and now are all psychological journeys.
And you published that book in 1979. This was a goal of yours as a young photographer to publish a book. You did that, but then you didn't settle down into a career as a full-time photographer. In fact, you took a very different route that led you ultimately to end up here in South Africa. What was your thinking at the time about why you didn't want to continue pursuing photography full time?
Well, this is a good question. First of all, I remember my mother clearly saying, "Whatever you do, Roger, don't become a photographer." Anyway, see, the thing is with me, and you know, I've been doing this for 52 years, and it's never been a commercial enterprise. It's always been about Roger's journey through his life, and that's the way it's always been. I never wanted it any differently, and I wouldn't say that I could have done a good job as a commercial photographer, because I wasn't interested in advertising, and I was rebellious, and I was not identifying with anything commercial at that point in my life. So I didn't have any interest in photographing clothes or pretty women or cars or any of the things that a commercial photographer did at the time. So that was the last thing I would want to do. And because I didn't want to do it, I would have done a bad job. So I felt that was not the right way to go, that I had to find other things, and photography would just be a hobby or a passion. And so that's the way it's been.
How did you end up going into geology?
Well, after these travels and whatever, I like being in the bush. I like being outside. I didn't like the office, and I didn't want to be part of an organization sitting in being told what to do. So I like the idea of roaming from place to place. You see, I've been roaming the world for 5 years, you know, 5 straight years with a backpack and a camera and whatever, roaming from place to place. So that was my life. And I felt by doing geology, I always liked the idea of Earth. I liked the idea of nature. Those are things that to this day are most sacred to me. And the fact that I could, you know, be outside and sort of finding treasure in the Earth and identifying with something more more material to me than something that I might find in an office really appealed to me. So I decided to go in that direction. And even to this day, you know, I would say that was one of the better decisions I made in my life.
It must be hard to be indoors for so long with your love of the outside world at the moment.
Well, you know, one thing it is, you're making a good point, though. You know, sometimes I really do miss going into the countryside. So nearly all my pictures since 1995 have been in Johannesburg. And so they're all in Johannesburg since 95 for 25 years. And when I go to make exhibitions, it's always in big cities. So I have to tell you, I do miss the countryside.
Let's talk about Dorps, right? Which is the first book. And that was in, you started taking photographs in South Africa in around 1982. Obviously, your photography had never really left your life. It was still with you, but now it was something you did on the side and not the main way that you earned your income. What was it about the kind of small towns of South Africa that you were seeing as you were going about your work as a geologist that began to intrigue and interest you and make you want to turn your lens on it?
Well, I thought they had firstly a unique aesthetic. They were, this was during the apartheid period here, so there was no tourism. These places were sort of frozen in time. They were relics of a more or less a colonial past. And there was something about these places that was very earthy, very real, very substantive, very different than any other small towns that I'd been in all my travels. I just immediately felt at ease there. And they weren't overwhelming places. You know, there were small little dots on the landscape. It wasn't like going into a big city in India or somewhere like this where it's, miles and miles of people. They're small places, and you could get to know them and find your place in them. And so this was very important to me. And I always said that this project, Dorps, which was 82 to 86, was the most important project of my career. It actually created the foundation for everything I've done afterwards. So I started using a square format camera. I went inside metaphorically and literally in people's houses. I found the motifs and the people that I would identify with as time went on, and I started using a strobe or a flash. And so I found myself in these places. And when I went inside, when I went inside those houses, that was the beginning. That was really the beginning.
You've also spoken about how towards the end of the Dorps project, and you have a specific moment that you remember knocking on a door, going into a house, and that kind of opened up a new period for you in terms of your work and would lead to the work that would form Platteland later on. But you've also described Dorps as the kind of move away from a mild optimistic approach, which you had previously, to something darker. Was that something darker influenced by what you found inside the houses and the people that you found there? Or was it kind of molded by a change in your own experience of the world on a personal level at that time?
Well, I think that element was always with me, but I wasn't able to find it out there, because there's a big difference between painting, writing, and photography. In photography, you actually got to be in the physical world. And so I guess traveling from India to Burma to this place to that place, I didn't get in the houses. I was always on the street taking pictures of things on the street, and all of a sudden I went into this other place inside, these dark, dingy, chaotic places, and it was like a bolt of lightning that hit me. But there's one thing that is interesting, and maybe this has a little bit more to do with Platteland. In 1972, I did my first film, and it was on a Beckett-like character, a person who was roaming from place to place in the Berkeley area, living on the edge, living on the margin. And, so I found I was into that repertoire, in my early 20s, because this film's shows that. And so I think I found it again when I was in those towns. And the thing that type of place emitted, or that type of place just set off a certain charge in me that I went after and continue to go after. You can't say why. People always ask why. I always answer the question, well, I don't know why I like a red flower more than a green flower, or this smell more than that smell. It's about the core. And if your core identifies with what you're doing, then you're likely to do a good job.
Let's talk a bit about Platteland quickly before we get on to some of the later work and the work in this book, which is... Platteland changed things for you, both in terms of kind of the audience that your photography was exposed to and the way that you became recognized as a photographer, but also in terms of the responses from people to the photographs. And you still describe it as probably some of your most controversial work. What do you think some of that controversy What did you feel were the reasons for that controversy at the time, and how did you react to that?
Well, the first thing is the pictures are strong and powerful, they're psychological, so they break the repressive state of the viewer. And most people don't like to be destabilized. They don't like to ask themselves questions. So those people are staring, and they're staring at you and making you uncomfortable. And so that's the first thing. I mean, if the picture didn't have that strength to them, that psychological edge, they would be controversial. They'd be nothing. They'd be just another documentary photograph of the white population in South Africa. So firstly, they had that edge. Secondly, the timing was such in South Africa and the world that South Africa was really, everybody was interested in South Africa. It was like, I don't know where now, Trump America now, but it was in the limelight. And so the pictures I took were of the poor white population. And the people hadn't realized that it wasn't only about rich whites dominating the black population here, that there was a white population that wasn't doing very well, that was living on the margin, that was also alienated and felt not part of where the country was going. And they were scared as well as where the country was going. So, you know, I found in these photographs a subculture that people in South Africa, I think, had repressed or tried to ignore, and the rest of the world didn't know about it. And so it became news. It became part of international news, what I did. And I guess it's very easy to for journalists and whatever to look at images and try to analyze them socially, politically, economically, but aesthetically is more difficult. So, you know, they were the result of the work was manyfold. One, I started to become well known. I remember Susan Sontag said this was one of the best books she's seen in years. And I remember in the major paper in South Africa, the art editor told me said it was the worst book in years. So this is where I stood. And I always have the joke that I tell people in 1995 in South Africa, I had one friend, and that was my dog Leroy. So everybody ran from me. The right wing here was unhappy with the way I portrayed the white people, and the politically correct left wing said, "Well, how dare you photograph people who aren't well off and well to do and part of the mainstream? You didn't have a right to do this." So I was not very popular, but this was very important for me because I got a lot of attention all over the world. And this made me believe that I should be spending a lot more time doing photography. So in 1995, I decided not to go to the countryside anymore and start working in Johannesburg. And I started working with a lady called Jenny De Silva, who was the wife of my printer Dennis De Silva, and Jenny and I spent 11 years together going from place to place, and we had an incredible time and experience doing photographs and finding places on the periphery that people weren't aware of. But I want to just say one thing. I know I'm sorry to talk too long, but
no.
You know, this is it's a very important point because there's so many people. 99% of the people really don't understand photography. Photography is no different than painting. And I always tell people, I say, if you were in a room with Picasso and somebody said, paint the rose, you know in a million years you can't paint the rose like Picasso. But people say, photograph the rose, and I'm here photographing the rose. They think that it's just a matter of pointing a camera and taking the pictures. It's very, very difficult to create powerful, complex, meaningful photographs. It's layer on layer on layer on layer, and it's a transformative process. So it's not about just telling somebody to stand against the wall and snapping a camera. There's sometimes thousands of steps that are required to get there, and people don't comprehend that. That's why when you look on the Facebook and Instagram, you know, you get a little bit dismayed after a while.
by the sheer volume of images and
See, the problem is that, you know, I mean, I'm again come from the old school where the individual has a the image has a special place in life, that for creating special images that have a life beyond your own life, and that's not the way where that's not where photography is right now.
At what stage do you think that you moved completely away from any kind of idea of being a documentary photographer towards an artistic practitioner who uses the medium of photographs to create their artworks? Was this a specific moment or a specific body of work that you would consider the kind of break point?
In Outland, in 1990, I started Outland in 1995, and for the first year or two in the Outland project, it looked a bit like Platelon. And then all of a sudden, something snapped. It was like in fault in geology. Something moved in a certain direction, and I started to transform. I started to become a director, interactor with the subjects, with the place, and started to, you know, create my own reality in these places with these people. So in about 97, this happened. And I remember in South Africa at the time when I went through the customs in Johannesburg, you had to fill out this blue form, and they said profession. So for many years, being a geologist, I said businessman or geologist, and you never in Africa, because I travel in Africa a lot, you would never say photographer, never. That's like a death. They wouldn't let you in the country. So I would never say photographer, but South Africa, where I was living there, so I used, eventually I put photographer. Then in 1997, I remember this famous time when I was coming back from London, and I wrote photographer artist in 1997. And this is when things started to change. I had developed the confidence to be able to transform the moment in Roger's own way, rather than necessarily document what was there.
However, there's definitely a link between the work that you created as artwork, as construct, or as images created in spaces where you were in control of what was going on. There were a lot of motifs and characters and things that were influenced by things that you had seen during your period of documentary work in the countryside. And a lot of those themes and motifs have carried on quite strongly through to all your future work. Animals, wires, birds, those kinds of things.
No, you're 100% right. You're making a very, very important point. Because, for example, from about 2002, there's nearly drawings in every picture. But where did these drawings come from? They came from people's houses in the Platelon. You know, you'll see in some of the pictures in the Platelon, the drawings on the wall that these people made. And I started to get interested in integrating drawing and photography. See, I had this latent need to do painting, you see, that started in 73. I had this need to paint. I didn't finish what I had to do. So when I saw these paintings on the wall in the 80s, I thought, well, it's really interesting to try to link painting, drawing lines in a photograph. So you're absolutely right. Most of the motifs that you even find today came from period of partly documentarian photography, and partly a period when I was actually documenting things.
We've got some questions, and I'll give them to you towards the end. But just to talk for a few minutes about the new book and the new exhibition. The World According to Roger Ballen is a book that accompanies an exhibition that was held at the Hall Saint Pierre in Paris, which is an art group museum, if my understanding is correct. I haven't been there. and I was just wondering about how that came about and what your approach to preparing the work for that exhibition was. And then we'll talk about some of the new things that are included in the exhibition, which are kind of unusual or new moves in new directions for you. But just to begin by saying, by asking you how it came about and what your approach was to preparing that.
See, I've always been interested in art groups. So that's the people that I work with and who did these drawings could be considered art group artists in a way. They weren't making art for the purpose of making art. They were just making drawings or whatever they were doing because they liked doing it. So the type of people in the environments that I've been involved in for, well, 35, 40 years now have been art brute environments. And I mentioned the people that in my entire career, all the subjects that I've worked with directly or indirectly, there's not one of them, not one has ever even been to an art museum or gallery. So they're not interested in art, but they're art brute artists. So I've been interested in that type of psyche for years, for decades. And so this was always an important part of my experience. And the Hall St. Pierre was one of the centers for art brute artists and art brute shows. So every time I've been to Paris, I've been to this museum, and I love the museum. And so I made contact with the director, Martine Lapassade, and she was very enthusiastic about working together. And then we decided to plan this exhibition, which opened in September 2019. And unfortunately, because of the virus, it's closed now. It closed in March. It's hopefully it'll open again. The show was supposed to run from September to July, end of July 2020. Right now it's closed, and hopefully it will open again. But so this is what happened. I felt that this museum symbolized or reflected or housed art that I really identified with, and aspects of my art could easily fit in there and have easily fit in there.
And obviously, this work also is accompanied by an installation, and installations have become quite a big part of your practice over the last few years. How do you approach installations, and what do you like about working in that mode, and what you feel it offers you that kind of brings a new way of looking at the photographs and of your process as a whole?
This is an interesting point because, from 95 to, I guess, the period of Asylum of the Birds, which began in 2009, I worked with people and in their rooms and in special buildings. And I sort of started, and during this time, I started to move things around. I started to try to create my own reality, and then photograph part of my own, the things that I created in relationship to the way things were there, and create the so-called Balinese aesthetic. And so over this period of time, I guess it started in about 2002 to the present, I started to become, as I said, not only more interactive with the people, but more interactive with the objects around me. And so this has continued to the present, but beginning in about 2013 or 14, I got this idea in my head, well, I shouldn't just be making photography shows. You know, it must be much more interesting to the public if I make installations as well as photographs, because, you know, an installation can be experienced in a much different way than, say, a photograph. A photograph is a two-dimensional object, basically, on a wall, on a white wall or a gray wall, and one has to try to enter that photograph, but you're still, you know, a couple meters away from it, and you're imagining all sorts of things about that work. And sometimes the picture has a great deal of influence on you, and sometimes it doesn't. But an installation is a you know, three-dimensional object which you can walk into. You can almost sometimes smell it. You can feel it. And it gives you a different experience of what my art's about. It expands my aesthetic. It's a parallel aesthetic. So when you start putting installations and shows together with my videos, with my photographs, with my drawings, you get a completely much more, I wouldn't say overwhelming aesthetic, but a much more expanded aesthetic. And so this is something I really like to do. And if I have the opportunity in future shows, I want to make installations, show videos, and maybe in the next show I have, we'll show some of these paintings as well.
I mean, something that doesn't get mentioned often is your kind of absurd sense of humor. And I suppose there's a lot of that in this particular book. Particularly, there are a lot of photos of you taken by your assistant, Marguerite Rousseau. But there are also photos where you kind of playfully recreate some of your own photographs. I mean, is having fun an important element of your process?
Yeah, I mean, people always think I'm this dark, unhumored, awful type of person, you know. So if people would actually look at these pictures, they'd see that they're quite humorous, they're quite absurd. They're not, I don't know, it's always interesting that the people think that they're dark, and maybe it's a reflection of their undeveloped state of being that they say they're dark. I mean, what do they actually do when they walk in city streets or stop on corners in Johannesburg and see poverty here, and then they don't think anything. But when they look at my pictures, they're disturbed and feel uneasy. So, you know, I'm very happy they feel this, because it means, I mean, the best thing possible for an artist is the work affects people. So it is great that they say these things. I'm delighted. But there is and you rightly pointed out, I would say there's dark humor, there's absurd humor. And this pervades my work. It pervades my work going back to boyhood. It pervades my work for 50 years. And I never walked out of a photographic situation depressed. It's always been an enlightening experience. I've always been enthusiastic. And I've always liked what I'm doing. I never walked out feeling depressed about the human species. I sometimes feel a lot more depressed in some of these urban shopping malls. A lot more depressed. I think there's a lot more darkness in some of those places than the places I work. At least my places have something human about them.
You were speaking about the films, and there was a question from one of the viewers about the Antwoord. And I guess we should mention that in terms of what that collaboration and the kind of exposure that it allowed you led to in terms of your own career and your process as far as making films and using films as part of your work changed.
Yeah, I met Ninja and Yolandi in 2005 or 6, and they were very enthusiastic about my work and said it influenced them really greatly, and they felt really, in a way, overwhelmed by its message, and then they were very inspired to, basically create the artwork in line with what I was doing in one way or another. And so, you know, we kept in touch for some time, and I think this really culminated, most importantly, when we did the I Think You're Freaky video, which went totally wild. I mean, it's got like 150 million hits right now. And this was a very important thing in my career for, I think, two important reasons. One, it introduced my work to a lot of young people who didn't know anything about me at the time. I mean, the music video, music business is probably 1,000 times bigger than the art photography business. So all sorts of young people got interested in what I was doing. And also, after this, I got interested in making films and videos. So each major project, and even less major projects since 2012 when I did Freaky, I've done videos with. And this has been a very important part of my career, because a video illustrates a different part of my aesthetic than my photographs do. And so again, somebody sees one of my videos and sees, it helps them put together what my pictures are about. And if they see my pictures, and then it helps them understand the video. So there's a parallel expansion of aesthetic by working in these different medias. But it's important to make the comment, you can't be just making these things to make them. They have to have a parallel quality to them. There has to be they have to be on the same level. There's no point just making a video to make a video, and it can bring your work down also.
And then we have another question, which is about Ralph Eugene Meatyard and whether or not you were influenced by his work at all as a young photographer. Obviously, drawing some parallels between the masked figures and some of the elements in your work?
Well, this is an interesting question from a few points of view. The first thing is during the time I was painting in 1973, I bought this Aperture book. It's a pink cover of Eugene Meteyard, and I can't say at the time I was influenced by him, but there must have been something. I can't remember why I bought the book, but there was something really special and different about it. So I don't know, whether it influenced my photography at the time. But after the Plotula and Outland books, his name started to come up a lot. And people started to compare my work to Meteyard, and I always felt my work had a lot more to do with Meteyard than, say, Don Arbus or somebody like that. I mean, Meteyard's work is much more psychologically challenging, at least for me it is. And so I don't know if I was influenced by him, but I certainly saw something parallel from what he was doing to what I was doing. And last year I went to Kentucky, the University of Kentucky in Lexington, and they invited me there to give a talk, and they had a Eugene Meteyard exhibition at the museum there, and I was the special guest there. And I'm hoping I got to know his son, and I hope someday in my Museum of Photography in Johannesburg, I can show some of his work.
Well, let's use that as an opportunity to talk to you about your Museum of Photography. At what stage is that? And how do you envisage it as a space in Johannesburg and as a space on the African continent in relation to photography and showing photography from around the world in Africa?
Yeah, well, firstly, I'm busy trying to put my thoughts together. I have a lot of interesting thoughts, but, for me, I think there are a few criteria I'm thinking about right now that might have relevance. The first thing is, I think the pictures need to have some sort of psychological impact on people. I just don't want to be showing the latest fashion photographs in the museum, or pictures of wildlife running across the Serengeti here. So I think the pictures have to have something to do with my aesthetic in some way or another. I mean, the thing is, the photography is a huge media, and you have to ultimately focus on something. They have a show of this and a show of that. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with doing that. But I think I need to be very focused, on what I do. And there has to be the museum and the center have to have certain goals in mind. And so, as I said, the pictures should have something psychological. They should have something directly or indirectly to do with Africa. And they should have some relevance to the South African audience, since the center is in Johannesburg. And hopefully, I've had a foundation here in South Africa for nearly 20 years, and it's always been my goal that photography can be an expander of people's consciousness and a better way of getting to know themselves in one way or another, and their environment at the same time. So, I hope we're able to achieve some of these goals. I mean, I'm not an idealist anymore at age 70, but I hope that it does make a contribution one way or another in the future.
And then there was another question around your portrait period, and when you were taking pictures of people, to what extent is the photograph that you produce an expression of how you see the person, or is it trying to show the viewer something about the person as kind of inner world and being, or is it a mix of the two?
Yeah, it has to be a mix of the two, because, the thing is if there's a beautiful woman there, I guess I can make her look strange or something, but, she has something beautiful about her, so, I can't make her look like an old man. That's what she is. So there's something about, it's like taking a lump of clay. That's the beginning of the molding of the thing. If it's a lump of clay, it's not a lump of steel. So, you find people that, I guess, there's something about the way they are that you feel a need to work with in one way or another. But, you know, that's just the first step. And I always say finding the right, the person, you're 5% there, unless you're like somebody takes a person and puts them against a wall and takes a picture. But for me, finding the person, I'm basically nowhere. So what next? So now I walk around some street, I find somebody that's sort of interesting. Well, what am I going to do with them? So it's mostly it's 95 transformation and 5% what's there. And that's what I said, that people don't understand that about photography. Good photography is a transformative process. It's not an objectification. Picasso, when he makes his drawing, is not objectifying something. He's transforming something. And that's the same in photography.
And then there was a question about being a geologist and someone who works with the earth. Has that ever translated into a desire to kind of work with materials from the ground in a kind of sculptural process? And then furthermore, the sculptures that you have been producing, what's your approach to the creation of those works? And is it different in any way to the approach that you've taken in the paintings?
Yeah, see, I think that's like, if you look at my photograph, there's something, the materials I use, whether it's charcoal or chalk, it feels very earthy, you see, like there's a feeling of earth in the pictures. The pictures are taken in environments that feel like they've been aged, that there's something that they've been subject to wear and tear in a way. So I think my relationship to earth is reflected in that way in the pictures. Look, you know, geology, you can come up with amazing metaphors of layers and faults and intrusions. You can take some of these things which are as poetic as anything there is in the world and say, okay, well, these are my basis of what I want to do in my work. But, you know, you're a long way from taking a good picture by understanding these geological terms. I mean, you're basically nowhere. I mean, photography is a visual medium. So you can read science, you can read novels, you can listen to people's stories, but I always say the camera doesn't have any ears, so you're left with nothing. You're left with your own creative impulse.
I mean, do you think that all these other explorations of different mediums, of sculpture, of painting, of the work that goes into installation, are they always going to be for you tied to showing in conjunction with photographs or to support a photographic project, or do you feel that they might end up being work that you could show on their own terms without any kind of relationship to the photographs?
No, I mean, I think if you see this show at Hall St. Pierre and see the World According to Roger Bellin books, you can see that a lot of the installations are works of art. So I could easily show my paintings or my installations in any museum, I think, in the world, and they would be considered works of art. But I think it's very interesting for the viewers to be able to link my photography with my other art forms. And as I said, it gives a more widened understanding of my so-called Bellin-esque aesthetic. And that was really the purpose of the World According to Roger Bellin book that I just want to mention two people before I forget tonight. You know, Colin Rhodes did an amazing job writing the book. He's been a long friend of mine and one of the real experts on my aesthetic. So he's a great intellect. He's has an amazing understanding of Art Brut and a deep understanding of my work. So, Colin, I don't know if you're looking at this interview tonight, but I want to thank you. And also want to make sure I thank my artistic director of nearly 13 years, Marguerite Rousseau, who's been made an amazing contribution to my art over these 13 years. So if she's listening, I really want to thank her. And she took most of the documentary photographs of the book are Marguerite's. And you know, they're really great pictures of me. The so-called artworks of Roger Bellin in their own way. So, Marguerite, if you're listening, thank you for all your tremendous dedication and the great work you did in this book and the great work you do for me every day of the year.
That's very kind, and that is true. All the photos of you in the book are credited to Marguerite. I guess quickly before we go, what obviously your plans are going to be affected by COVID-19 and what that means for traveling and culture around the world in the months to come. But currently, in terms of work, what are you working on, and what can audiences hopefully look forward to in the coming months?
Well, thank you very much for asking. There are four or five important projects that I'm involved in right now. So the last 2 or 3 years, I've only taken color photographs. So people know Roger Ballen mainly as a black and white photographer, which I did for 50 years. The last 2 or 3 years, I've done color. And in the world, according to Roger Ballen, it's the first time actually some of my color photographs have been published. So in the book, you'll see some of my color work, and which I'm very proud of and very happy about. So that's the one thing there. That's one of the color photographs, and you can see see one of those in there. The second thing that I'm finishing now is a project on I did a photograph for 5 years of a particular subject that I work with who believes he's a rat. So worked on this project of this man who considers himself a rat. He wears his rat mask, and he does very absurd antisocial behavior. And I did these photographs of him, and recently made quite a long video. It's a 20, it'll ultimately be a 20 or a 30 minute a video with a great team, Justin LG, Paul Gilpin, Daniel Buckland, and Richard Ingram, and with Marguerite as well. So we did what I think is going to be an extremely powerful film video of this man who believes he's a rat. So this, I hope, will come out in September, October, November, or early 2021. I'm busy editing the film, and hopefully the book will come out at the same time. And now I'm also doing painting. So I think I've been working on the Roger Ballen Center for photography. So these are the main things that I'm involved in. And, so I'm not that unhappy, although all my exhibitions are closed. And most importantly, I just should mention this about the book. If people do get to Paris, the exhibition will continue to the end of July. Maybe I'll be lucky they'll continue it afterwards. But, you know, the book comes on the show at Hall Saint-Pierre. So perhaps by June or July, maybe the show will open again. I hope so. And then you can visit the show and see and appreciate some of the comments that we made today.
Well, thank you very much, Roger. And before I go and we go, let me just remind people who are watching in South Africa that if you click in the link in the bio on the David Crit bookstore page, you can go and order the book. If you order the book before midnight on April the 30th, Roger will sign and dedicate your copy, and you'll get it after the lockdown. And hopefully that will be sooner rather than later. But in the meantime, hope you enjoyed the interview. Roger, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Tim, and thank you. Really, your questions were really great. It's always wonderful to speak with you, and really appreciate your time. And thank you, David Krug, for all the support here. I really appreciate it, and also the Jonathan Ball Company for supporting me on the project.
Great. Thanks very much, and everybody have a
Thank
good
you,
evening.
Man.
And
Thank you.
Roger,
Thank you.
See you soon.
See you soon. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.